High FM 101.9 megahertz of life.
We're going to have the privilege of chatting to Dr. Carl. He is our Australian science communicator. Dr. Carl, good morning. How are you doing today? Dr. Carl, good morning. Can you hear us?
Hello. How are you? Dr. Howard, lovely to be with you again.
Nice to be with you. So if a coin is dropped from a great height, can it kill us?
Only if it's in a vacuum. If it's in a vacuum, it will keep on accelerating faster and faster and can reach a relatively high speed, even though the coin itself is fairly light, only 2.5 grams or so. Given enough height, it can get lots of speed. But in the Earth's atmosphere, most coins are fairly light and will tend to flutter like a leaf. You might have very heavy coins like an ounce. Was there a thing called a Krugerrand ounce, which was like 28 grams?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So there you're looking at not just 2.5 grams, but 10 times that. And that might, if it were to fall on its side rather than flat, if it were to fall on its side and not flutter, then that could build up quite a bit of speed. And then that could cause quite a lot of injuries. But in the case of regular coins, they'll on average reach a speed of about 40 kilometers per hour. This was tested back in the 60s and 70s by an American scientist who got coins onto little helium balloons and then used some amazing new radio technology to release the coins from a height of a few hundred meters and then try to have the coins land on him. And he ran around trying to be hit by the coins. And he said that when he did get the coins landing on him on his hands, it just felt like a stinging. And he worked out they were doing only about 25 kilometers an hour. And they'd reached their top speed just in the first 15 meters. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, they're heavier. And then it was followed up by the Mythbusters, who then went for a higher speed of 65 kilometers per hour and then fired them out a cannon at themselves. And once again, just a sort of a stinging ouch that irritates. But what could be dangerous would be a ballpoint pen, a heavy metal one, because that would tend not to flutter. It would fall point first. But the other thing is that if it was heavy and it was falling point first and the point was quite small, then you've got maybe a millimeter of impact and that could actually possibly penetrate a skull or something like that.
Amazing. So interesting. Let's just talk about a respectful disagreement. There used to be a time when we could do that sort of thing, but we seem to be more and more polarized. And I'm fascinated by some of the research that's gone into this because it really does concern me on a daily basis that we just don't seem to be able to have rational conversations without politics and real agenda creeping into it.
Yes, it used to be for many, many decades that you could have people who had different political persuasions but would still meet for a barbecue and have a cup of tea. And the situation has always been that there's roughly 7% or 8% of the population on each extreme, the extreme right and the extreme left, who are totally welded on or rusted into their points of view and will not change under any circumstances whatsoever and refuse to listen to any new data. But then you've got about 85% of the people in the middle who were quite rational and saying, well, you got a point there. That is the case. And we've ended up with a polarization, and the 85% in the middle are now what they call the exhausted majority. And all they want is that the government just simply gets the job done and looks after people with regard to health, education and welfare and medical and all of the other things. And so this seems to have been pushed to some degree by the social media. And as an example of how crazy it's got, in America, one-third of the Democrats and one-third of the Republicans, they each reckon that the greatest threat to American democracy are people from the other political party, not people from another country. And that just shows you how ridiculous that they've become, that they can't admit that the people from the other side of politics in their own way love their country and they see them as hating their country and wanting to destroy their country. And so there's different things you can do about it. I came across this guy, Dr. James Arvanitakis, Arvanitakis, who's written stories on this respectful disagreement and as a sociologist has been trying to follow it and see what to do. And he's a whole bunch of solutions like don't try to have an intellectual zero-sum game.
Right.
Gonna lose.
Yeah.
But rather set up one where you can both win, or and don't do this stacking on where if somebody attacks somebody for saying something that they weren't didn't quite think through, don't sort of try to add fuel to the fire. Also learn to communicate, which is a hard thing. Stop creating false dichotomies where or false binaries where you say either you 100% agree with me or you specifically want to eat babies for breakfast. Don't create false binaries.
Absolutely. Yeah, because in fact that is how we treat people. The minute you disagree, then you're evil. Because and then we attack the personality behind it.
And yeah, there's good and bad points of view, and I have made mistakes myself in the past, and being able to recognize it sometimes, not straight away as I would hope, but later, it made me realize that, yeah, we all make mistakes, and so we should have some degree of humility and acceptance. But certainly thinking that anybody who disagrees with you politically is against your survival, against your country, that's really showing how bad it's gone. And I think part of it is the social media, where there's been a vast upswell in hateful dialogue and clickbait. And the thing is that the only people who benefit from the clickbait are the big social media companies like Google, Facebook and Amazon, who get between 1 and 5 cents every time you click on something that says your political opponent eats dogs for breakfast or has bad breath.
What's I wonder if they could reduce the incidence of this type of behavior if they forced people to use real names behind their social media accounts. In other words, on Twitter, I'll end up having the most terrible arguments with entities I don't even know because I don't know who they are and I don't know what the person is, whereas I'm there with my name and my whole history for anybody to find out.
That, but it's always very easy to fake an identity on the web. So it's called spoofing. And so I could spoof an email from you, howard@howard.com, saying, hey, you have just been the recipient of $40 million. Please ring me. So I think more importantly, maybe we need to actually have some government regulation of the social media in the sense that the tobacco companies did not clean up that act because they realized that they were dealing in a death-dealing substance, but because the governments forced them to. So we need some degree of government control, but of course not too much. And then you're talking about censorship and so forth. That's really messy, but we definitely need to do something, but I'm not too sure what.
Dr. Carl, thank you. As always, fascinating conversation. We chat to Dr. Carl, the Australian science communicator, every Wednesday at this time.